The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Thank you, and welcome to the Free Library's stimulating, and this evening I mean that in all senses, authors series. The book topics discussed in this room are wide-ranging. Something I mentioned, because I'm guessing that not all of you were here for the last author I introduced, a noted biblical scholar. Before we get to tonight's speaker, though, I must ask you to turn off your cell phones, or, as a tribute to our guest, put them on vibrate. Thank you. Tonight's event will be a conversation between our two authors. David Eisenbach is an historian who teaches both at his alma mater, Columbia University, and at the Manhattan School of Music. His two previous books are on the political importance of the gay rights movement and on the media's effect on our national security and democracy. He has teamed up with our other guest to write One Nation Under Sex, which might have been titled One Nation Under Sexed, had it not been for the life work of Larry Flint. Born in Kentucky in 1942, Larry Claxton Flint served in the Army and the Navy, was a poker player, bootlegger, and eventually opened a bar called the Hustler Club in 1968. The club's popular newsletter morphed into Hustler Magazine, which was first published in 1974. I offered to introduce Larry Flint tonight, not because I loved how he made me look in the Hustler picture spread Naked Cartoonists, but because in 1988, I had a very small part in getting the Association of American Editorial Cartoonists to file an amicus brief in support of Flint's historic Supreme Court case, Hustler Magazine v. Falwell. The case ended in a unanimous verdict supporting the right of cartoonists to parody public officials, even if it means the, and I quote, intentional infliction of emotional distress. I would say that that is actually the definition of cartooning, or at least any cartoon worth drawing. And for that, cartoonists everywhere thank Larry Flint. The coda to that case, however, was not just the cementing of free speech rights for cartoonists, but it was the start of an unlikely friendship between Larry Flint and Jerry Falwell. After Falwell died, our guest wrote a generous-spirited tribute to his former nemesis in the LA Times, in which he noted that, in fact, the two had much in common and loved to fight. Flint also quoted his own mother, who said, who, quote, always told me that no matter how repugnant you find a person, when you meet them face to face, you will always find something about them to like, unquote. Well, tonight we're face to face with our guests, Larry Flint and David Eisenbach. Thank you.
Testing. Yeah, I couldn't hear the introductory that took place, but I'm sure that she introduced David Osmark, my co-author, and myself. When I decided that I wanted to do this book, I knew that nobody would want to read a history book written by a pornographer, so I reached out. So I reached out to my friend David Osmark, who's professor of history at Columbia University, and a very, very bright guy, and familiar with the subject matter, and it's been really terrific working with David. And if he hadn't got involved in the project, I'd still be working on it today. So we owe him a lot. I often get asked if is there any particular stories in this book that are my favorite. They're really not. They all are. Some are a little bit more surprising than others. But at the first look, the first read of the book, you may not fully understand our purpose. We weren't interested in just writing about the sex lives of presidents, first ladies, mistresses, or lovers. We wanted to also know how these private and personal lives affected policy. And we think that we made a connection in many of the stories that we covered. There's also some stories you'll find in there where you had heard rumors about them throughout the decades, but never really got the full story. I think it's been difficult for a lot of historians to deal with the issue of, say, Thomas Jefferson as an example. It's hard for people to imagine this magnificent man who drafted the Declaration of Independence would actually father six children by a slave girl, Sally Hemings. But he did, and we weren't able to establish that until 1998 by DNA. There's many other scandals that existed at the founding of the nation, including famous first congressional investigation was Alexander Hamilton. But my initial thought was to see if these sex scandals that are prevalent in our political culture today, if they really existed in the founding of our nation. And they really did. So we wrote about them all, and we think the book is well documented and well researched. One of my favorites in there was finding out that we actually had a gay president, James Buchanan, in the 1850s. And David, you talk a little bit
sure.
about Buchanan.
James Buchanan is a really remarkable case, and he illustrates our point about how the personal does affect the political. He was elected from Congress from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, a heavily abolitionist portion of the country. And he arrives in Washington, D.C., and he soon falls under the tutelage of Senator William Rufus King from Alabama, a slave owner. And they develop a close bond that becomes a romance for 32 years. They live together. They are constantly seen around D.C. together. Everybody knows that they have a romantic relationship. They're known about D.C. as the Siamese twins because they're so close. And Andrew Jackson calls them Miss Nancy and Aunt Fancy. So it's well known in D.C. That they have this relationship. But the interesting and the important thing is that Senator William Rufus King, the slave owner, indoctrinates this northern congressman later to become senator and then president of the United States with a sense, a romantic notion of the slave owners and slavery, a sense that slaves are happy where they are, that they are important, the slave economy is important for the stability of the republic, and that it must be defended no matter what. And James Buchanan bends over backwards throughout his career to defend slavery And then when he becomes president of the United States, actually through his passivity, winds up encouraging the secessionists and refuses to crack down on the secession when the states start to leave in the wake of Abraham Lincoln's election in 1860. Here you have one of those cases where that personal relationship, that romantic relationship, which historians have never wanted to recognize, even though it's in their letters and it's in the correspondence of people of their time, historians, by ignoring that, have missed that important part of the story of America and the Civil War. So that's just one of the stories that has that connection between the personal and the political.
I worked a great deal on the story about the Kennedys, and look, I'm the first person that will defend a philandering president. I think if you can fight two wars and balance the budget at the same time, you should be able to sleep with whoever you want to. But Kennedy was so, and I grew up in a Kennedy mystique with Camelot and all that can-do attitude. And Americans really felt good about their country. But Kennedy was very, very careless in the affairs that he chose to have. He wanted the starlets like Angie Dickinson and Marlena Dietrich and Marilyn and... So here you got the highest profile person in the world wanting to have sex with the highest profile women in the world. So that was a recipe for disaster right there. But the thing that disappointed me the most is I remember as a kid that how America held Jackie O in such awe. She was treated with royalty. Well, she was having an affair even before the president was assassinated and continued to have them afterwards. And one of those people was Bobby Kennedy, who was John Kennedy's brother. So Camelot sort of started to come loose at the ends as far as I was concerned. But one area that David might address a little bit more about this is the press has been indifferent over a 250-year history, but they were definitely covering for the president until after the Cold War. Otherwise, they protected Roosevelt, they protected Truman and Kennedy and what have you. So that's why Clinton got caught in that bee's nest that he did, because all bets were off. And it's still that way today. It's in a 24-hour media cycle. It's still pretty bizarre. I would frankly like to see Americans have less of a knee-jerk attitude towards sex and think about it more the way the Europeans do. They feel that their politicians have an affair, and that's why they take the three-hour lunches. You know. everything in America has to be so puritanical, but we know that it's really not that way. So why we live such hypocritical lives, I don't quite have a full understanding of that.
One of the questions we're often asked is, are we better off today with having the internet and this post-Cold War era where the press is no longer covering and protecting the president, or are we worse off? Right? The knee-jerk is, oh, it was kind of better not knowing these stories, right, because it was none of our business. The problem with that is, in Jack Kennedy's case, he knew that the press was not going to expose his affairs, and so he never had to moderate his behavior. But there was one person who wasn't looking the other way, and that was J. Edgar Hoover, who was the director of the FBI. For 47 years, J. Edgar Hoover assembled the sex files on every congressman, senator, Supreme Court justice, and president, and then used those files to blackmail the U.S. federal government. He created a sort of essentially a government within the government and was able to blackmail every president. And then one of the presidents he blackmailed was John F. Kennedy. He had caught Kennedy having a fling with an East German prostitute. And the FBI believed this woman, Ellen Romisch, was an East German spy. So Hoover had the ability to destroy Kennedy. And he even leaked it to Senator Whispering Willie Williams of Delaware, a real prude, a Republican who was determined to tear down the Kennedys by exposing this sex scandal. Well, the Kennedys panicked, and Robert Kennedy knew there was only one man who could stop the U.S. Senate from investigating the president, and that man was J. Edgar Hoover. So Hoover said to Robert Kennedy, okay, I'll do it on two provisions. Number one, you reappoint me as FBI director. And number two, you give me the authority to bug and wiretap Martin Luther King Jr. Robert Kennedy felt he had no choice. He had to save his brother's presidency and his own political career, so he gives Hoover the official approval to do so. Hoover brings in the leaders of the Senate, shows them the sex files on all their senatorial colleagues. That very same day, Senator Williams announces, oh, no, we're not going to investigate this minor little thing. It's got nothing to do with the president. End of story. Hoover then takes the authority from Robert Kennedy, the Attorney General, and JFK, and uses that to catch Martin Luther King having his own affairs on tape, and then uses those tapes to try to sell them or push them into the media and persecute King. Fortunately, in those days, the media didn't bite. They didn't think it was newsworthy to publicize this great man's personal life. But the fact of the matter is that because of that press silence, the president and the presidents were vulnerable to the insidious man, J. Edgar Hoover.
I've got some real problems with the press over the centuries. When Dwight Eisenhower went to England as Supreme Allied Commander during World War II, the Brits gave him a 23-year-old driver named Kay Summersby. He carried on an affair for 4 years that Eisenhower was there. When he came back to the United States with a little ticker tape parade, and the Republicans grabbed him up and wanted him to run for president, I said, but we know all about Miss Summersby, and she can never be a part of your life. Well, I guess country comes first, so that's a decision he made. She went about writing two books after this, chronicling her relationship with Ike. And you never seen a word of that in print, not a word of airtime, nowhere. It was like that woman totally did not exist. And the reason being is the press took it on themselves to say that the nation was served best by not knowing that Ike was a philandering president. Now, I think for the press to have this kind of power, I think it almost strikes on of tyranny, except opposite of government. And I think the press has been guilty of that many times, is when you're, it's not that you're covering up someone's sex life, you know, you're covering up the hypocrisy, and that's what this whole issue is about when politicians misbehave. It's not that someone wants to expose what they're doing sexually, but just that they're being hypocrites and they won't own up to it.
It's sort of interesting to kind of see how the press has treated the personal lives of presidents and first ladies from the early republic through our contemporary life. And in the early republic, the president and first ladies, their private lives, their sex lives were fair game. There were sex scandals in the press about Thomas Jefferson, as we mentioned, Alexander Hamilton, the Maria Reynolds scandal, in which when he was a young Secretary of Treasury, he was caught paying a man named James Reynolds for the rights to sleep with James Reynolds' wife, Maria Reynolds. Thomas Jefferson tried to destroy Hamilton's career and with it the National Bank by exposing that affair. The Federalists, Hamilton's group, retaliated by exposing the affair with Sally Hemings, other affairs of Thomas Jefferson. Dolly Madison, her alleged affairs were all in the press. So, you know, it was a free-for-all back in the early republic. And that all changes in the 20th century with the rise of the national security state and the professionalization of the journalistic career, so that now journalists begin to see themselves as part of the establishment. They're there to protect the president, and that gets heightened with the Cold War. With the end of the Cold War and the rise of the internet, that's no longer the case. It becomes impossible to contain these stories, and so we are left with, in many ways, a kind of return to the way it was in the early republic. Now we just have to be mature enough to deal with these stories so that while we might get entertained by them, we never allow our political life to be hijacked for a year and our presidency to become contained and distracted the way we did during the Monica Lewinsky scandal.
When I mentioned earlier about what we felt it was important to make the connection about how these affairs of relationship affected policy. One of the best examples of that is Woodrow Wilson. His wife, Edith, when he was in the White House, I'll make the story short, he had a massive stroke. And with the help of the White House doctor, she covered this up from the press and Congress for like a total of 3 months. She answered all of his communications as though they were coming from him. And the whole nation didn't have a clue as to what was going on. And there was an important vote coming up in the Senate as the Treaty of Versailles, which would allow America to become part of the League of Nations, which Wilson was working on at the time. And who knows, if it would have passed, it could have changed the outcome of World War I and II, and who knows the ultimate effect it would have on history. I mean, we finally got the United Nations, which was a version of that. But it only lost by 3 votes in the Senate. And Senator Lodge had the votes to stop the defeat and break the tie. But there was nobody that could negotiate with him because Wilson couldn't negotiate with him. And it would expose his wife if there was any attempt on her part to do it. So the treaty went down in defeat. So that tells us two things about that. Succession of power is very important. If someone is not capable of governing, you know, that should be corrected immediately. And also, they should let us know that, not that women aren't capable, but we elect a president. We don't really elect a first lady, and we don't expect them to be making presidential decisions. Even though I'm sure that has happened in many administrations in the past. But
the case of Edith Wilson is one of those cases where, you know, it's a problem that the press was not more aggressive, that they allowed this kind of this pose, you know, that she allowed her to kind of run the White House without them probing and pushing further to actually see the president. And they gave him that space. They protected the president there. But, you know, you have the case of the Roosevelts, Here you have this complicated marriage where in the White House, Roosevelt has his girlfriend, Missy Lehand, living in the room next to him, and Eleanor has her girlfriend, Lorena Hickok, living in the room next to her, right? And they have this open relationship, and everybody in the kind of White House knows about this. The maid staff knows about this. They write about it in their diaries and later on memoirs. But the public doesn't know about it. Now, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Well, you know, on one hand, Roosevelt needed Missy Lehand. I mean, she was essential to his ability to operate and essential to his ability to kind of lead the nation, right, to kind of get going again and become the great leader that he, of course, became. And in Eleanor's case, Lorena Hickok, this former reporter with the AP, becomes her main advisor, in fact, pushes her to break the mold of what it was meant to be a first lady, which was traditionally just kind of the White House social operator. And Lorena Hickok gets Eleanor Roosevelt to hold her own press conferences, to have her own radio show, to travel the country, to become a real force and face of the New Deal. So, you know, that was a good thing where the press was not involved in exposing these affairs, right? So, again, it's never that simple. And as you're going to see in the book, there are plenty of cases when it kind of breaks both ways.
The only other president that might have had an active libido as Kennedy was probably Warren Harding. It's said that he made love to women and every conceivable place in the White House, from the broom closet to the pantry, and Kennedy used to even joke, you know, that he wanted to be everywhere Harding was, but Harding happened to be our worst president, and there was a saying about, and Wilson, although we haven't talked about it much, was pretty much of a ladies' man himself, but it said that the difference between Wilson and Harding is Wilson preferred the brothels of Paris and Harding preferred the whorehouses of Columbus, Ohio. So we've, both Republicans and Democrats, we've had a randy bunch of guys that, you know, believe me, they're not all made out of marble and stone. They're made out of flesh and blood, just like us. But.
Right. And in the case of Warren G. Harding, here's a man who had lots of mistresses, including the wife of his good friend, a woman named Carrie Phillips. And he was also carrying on an affair with a 22-year-old girl from his hometown, Nan Britton, and he proceeds to knock her up. And then he decides he's going to run for the presidency in 1920. And when the party bosses call him in to the smoke-filled back room, they say to him, you know, Warren, is there anything in your background that could possibly jeopardize your presidential run? And he said, gentlemen, you know, I swear to God, there is absolutely nothing that could doom this presidential run. And then a couple of days later, he gets approached by Mr. Phillips, Carrie's husband, to ask for a payout. He then has to go back to the party bosses and say, well, I forgot to tell you about this and this and this, and I got this little girl, and, you know, we need some money. We need money real quick. So the Republican Party assembled a slush fund. And this was run by a guy named Henry Daugherty, later to become Attorney General of the United States. And Harry Daugherty goes around collecting all this money from these contributors. And, of course, when Warren G. Harding comes into the presidency, these guys who shelled out, they want a return on their investment. So Harry Daugherty now, as the Attorney General, actually starts to accept payments from criminals to, in return for the Justice Department not prosecuting them. The director of the Veterans Bureau is selling narcotics that were meant for wounded World War I vets on the open market. And you have the Secretary of the Interior leasing the oil rights to the Teapot Dome Oil Reserve in return for $600,000, which in today's money is well over $15 million. So what you have here is the most corrupt administration in American politics, political history, right? And the origins of this corruption trace right back to Warren G. Harding's hyper sex life, right? We often hear about the Teapot Dome scandal, but I think very few people realize the origins of this go back to an affair. Did you have another favorite story?
Huh?
Do you have another favorite story?
We talked about Clinton, and people want to know how he got away with what he did. Well, we've always perceived Clinton as being this lovable rogue, even when Jennifer Flowers come out and accused him of having this affair. I think all Americans knew he was guilty. But I liked a twinkle in his eye, you know. And I think that's why, in the end, that they forgave Clinton. But there's a big difference between somebody like John Edwards, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and Clinton. Yeah. While they forgave Clinton, they can never forgive Schwarzenegger, or they can never forgive Edwards. And, you know, the American people, when it comes to push and shove, can always draw a line. And sometimes they'll overlook an affair. But when it goes beyond that, there's no forgiveness.
The tragedy of it all, we can look back and it almost seems kind of funny what happened in 1998, with the Clinton scandal. But the 9/11 Commission report actually pointed out that the Clinton administration was in a war against Osama bin Laden. Bill Clinton, in his last years, was determined to kill Osama bin Laden because, and we didn't know this at the time, not only did al-Qaeda strike at the U.S. embassies in Africa, among other attacks on U.S. Facilities, but they tried to assassinate Bill Clinton on three occasions. Twice in Pakistan and once in the Philippines. Now, these plots were foiled, but Clinton knew, these guys are after me and they're after America and they're ratcheting up the intensity of their strike, so I've got to kill this guy before I leave office. The problem was that every time Clinton would push his staff to launch more strikes and to do airstrikes against the terrorist camps in Afghanistan, the staff would say, well, we're worried about being accused of wagging the dog. Which was a movie that had come out in which a president tries to distract the American public from a sex scandal by waging a war against Albania. This was something that, according to the 9/11 Commission, inhibited the administration from going more aggressively after Osama bin Laden. Now, if we had killed Osama bin Laden in the late 1990s, perhaps we could have avoided not only 9/11, but Iraq. I mean, think about what a different world we would be living in. If the administration had successfully killed Osama bin Laden. So, there is another one of those cases where, we've got to learn, yes, these stories are great and they're fun and they're kind of interesting and funny, but they actually have huge consequences.
See, that's what hurts the country. They spent 2 years trying to impeach President Clinton. And during that 2 years, a lot of things just went to hell. And I believe that that's part of the reason why we wound up with 9/11. But our politicians, they seem to always be taking the eye off the ball, They have all of these petty grievances, and everything they do is about politics. Nothing they do is about the country or what's good for the people. It's always what's good for them. And I think voters are starting to wake up. You've got to vote, and you got to vote in your own self-interest. And if you can't make a decision, just vote for the lesser of the two evils. But we need to create a revolving door in Washington, D.C., so we can get rid of some of those clowns.
Now, on that note, why don't we open up some questions in the audience? There's going to be a microphone that'll come around. I think this gentleman has a question right here. And just if you could wait for the microphone to get to you.
Given the dirt potential on Hoover himself and his relationship, how come they didn't just say, hey, screw you?
Yeah.
You know, we'll just blurb, there goes your fantasy life.
Right. Well, that, okay, what you're referring to here, and this is the key to kind of, Hoover is this fascinating character because he is in this long-term relationship with his number two man at the FBI, Clyde Tolson. And he is extremely anxious about his homosexuality. And the more anxious he is and fearing that other people can expose him and destroy him, he decides to defend himself by getting the sexual dirt on everybody else. So it would be a case of mutually assured destruction. So the more anxious he is about his sexuality, the more determined to become the greatest sexual blackmailer in America. So that's the reason there. And he's in a vicious cycle. He was a very miserable man, and he made a lot of other people miserable, too.
Right. Well, Hoover did not just use the political system to get rid of people he wanted to. He was very good with the press. He had a DJ in New York by the name of Drew Pearson, and one in Washington, what was his name?
Well, there's Walter Winchell in New York, Drew Pearson.
Yeah, Walter Winchell in New York and Drew Pearson in Washington, D.C., and he used to leak stories, and it didn't necessarily have to be about politicians. Hey, if you were a celebrity and you were a liberal, don't worry, you immediately got labeled a pinko, you know, and he would immediately release whatever information he had on you to the press. That's what made Hoover so dangerous, is because he was more powerful than the president. He was more powerful than anybody that we could even imagine, and he used his power in some of the most ruthless ways.
And part of the problem, too, was because Hoover assembled the sex files on journalists, if journalists were afraid of him, so they wouldn't criticize him. Now, remember, this is at the time when the mob, which was just kind of running, you know, some prostitution and gambling rings, you know, starts to get involved with first with prohibition and then with importations of drugs. They take over the unions. They take over Vegas. They become this insidious force in American life, flooding our cities with drugs. And yet no congressman, no senator, no newspaper man could be like, why isn't J. Edgar Hoover cracking down on the mafia? Because they were afraid of him. And, you know, that is pretty powerful stuff. Now, it begs the question, why wasn't Hoover cracking down on the mafia to begin with? And there is suspicion, we go into it in the book, that he himself was being blackmailed by the mafia because they got the dirt on Hoover. All right? Yeah. So, you know, once again, this is it's kind of a dark story at moments. There was another hand over here.
You indicated that Eleanor was very accepting of Missy Lehan, yet I had read accounts in which, on Roosevelt's death, Eleanor asked if she was in the room at the time. Was there some tension that really was there?
Oh, well, I think you're thinking about Lucy Mercer. Now, Lucy Mercer was a different story. Lucy Mercer was Eleanor's social secretary when they first came to D.C. when they were young. And he was an assistant secretary of the Navy at, I think, 30 years old. And he begins an affair with Eleanor's social secretary, Lucy Mercer. Eleanor finds out about this. She finds letters from Lucy to Franklin and offers Franklin a divorce. Franklin was willing to take it. He was tempted. In fact, Lucy Mercer was the love of his life. And he decided, well, first I got to check with Mom. And Franklin's mother said, absolutely not. If you divorce Eleanor, I'm going to cut you off financially. So he decides, all right, I'm going to stick with Eleanor, fortunately for the country, because, of course, they become very important political pair. But Eleanor says to him, okay, I'll take you back on two conditions. One, you never see Lucy Mercer again. And two, we never share a bed again. Franklin had no problems with the second option, but the first... was too much. He continued to see Lucy Mercer, and as you point out, it was Lucy Mercer who was there in Warm Springs when he died in 1945. Yes?
I guess a lot of media outlets today, you know, are indoctrinated with, like, falsities. How much of this book is your personal conjecture?
You just check out the footnotes. You know, what we were, yeah, we wanted to make sure, you know, that every claim, every major assertion, right, is footnoted. So you go right back to the book, and if you kind of question, you know, what we're writing here, you know, it's all there, and we try as much as possible to make sure we get to the original source, right? So yeah. In the back.
In 1920, women had the right to vote with whatever the amendment was. And yeah, right, I don't know. Come That's on, okay. Do you know which amendment it was? I think it might have been the 20th or the 19th. Thank you. You're so kind.
All right.
Anyway, and I mean, it's been you know, suggested that it was that women's vote that put Harding in the White House. Now, you know, that twinkle in his eye that you talked about Clinton may have been, you know, the twinkle in his eye that women saw. And he did cut a very striking figure, and he was tall and well-dressed. And, you know, they talk about how women now, in the last however many elections, see that good-looking guy image. Do you give any credence to the possibility that they saw that bad boy image there?
Yeah, I, you know, it's always part of it, right? It's part of the appeal of a politician, right? They always have a number of tools in the toolbox, and one of them is the ability to seduce the crowd, right? And you know, for example, Dominique Strauss-Kahn's wife. When asked about, you know, how can you condone your husband's philandering? And everybody knows about this in France. And she said, his job is to seduce. And she's right. And I think that the job of the politician attracts a certain personality type. You have to remember, they don't get into it right away for the power. The power comes down the line. They got to start off, you know, work in the PTA, work in the senior centers, right? They're starting off, you know, running for assembly, right? The money isn't there. The power isn't there right away. The prestige, the influence, the cars, the jets, that is not there. So what is there? It is getting up there at Tuesday evening and being in front of a crowd, wowing a crowd, getting something, feedback from the crowd. There's a neediness to politicians. That kind of type, right, is, I think, more predisposed to, you know, the opportunities that a lot of politicians have. So, you know, it's they're on the make, all of them. Yeah, in the back.
Thank you, and fascinating conversation. Back to Clinton, do you feel, I mean, I replay this scenario 100 times, and I always feel that if Clinton had said to the Star people, go screw yourselves, this is my life and arguably Hillary's, I'm not going to testify about my sex life, would that have been a workable scenario, one, and would it? How do you think it would have played with the American public?
Oh, I think it definitely would have been a worthless scenario. You know, George Bush Sr., while director of the CIA, had a very torrid affair with one of the female associates at the CIA. And when this came out in his campaign for the presidency against Clinton, they were the little Stone Phillips got into it on one interview and really upset him in the Oval Office. But for that part, for the most part, Bush shut that down. He just absolutely refused to talk about that issue. That's where a lot of politicians, including Clinton, get in trouble because they want to try to talk their way out of something like that, and you just can't do it.
Well, one of the things that, came out of the Star, this was the Jennifer Flowers expose, was the Clintons' famous 60 Minutes spot, right, where the two of them went up there and they talked about how they had difficulties in their marriage. That resonated with people because, marriage is not easy. And they kind of were human about it, and there was something new and refreshing about that moment and that couple. And it sent a message to the Democratic Party that these two are not going to be the punching bags like Mike Dukakis, right, was. This duo can actually take the punches and kind of survive the Republican attack machine. So many people, including Mary Matlin, who was an advisor to the Bush campaign at that moment, saw that and was like, uh-oh, these people are serious. All right, they're going to be tough. You mean in the terms of the cover-up later on? I think.
Lying in Congress.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
In retrospect, I'm sure he plays that out in his mind every night.
Well, you know, I've got a good friend that says he believed Clinton because he said oral sex is not having an affair. It's got to be intercourse or it don't count. Now, I don't buy that argument, but Clinton may have been thinking about a lot of that in his own mind.
Yes,
The editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer in the 1992 campaign was one Maxwell E.P. King, who, as I'm sure both of you know, is the grandson of Maxwell Perkins. And he was on a radio show on the local public radio station at the time, and the question of the two Jennifers came
up. Yes, that's right.
Flowers and
Fitzgerald.
And his
Jennifer Fitzgerald was George Bush's alleged mistress.
And his answer was that George Bush's affair was not newsworthy because he was an old man. He was 68. And basically, he probably couldn't get it up anymore, but Clinton could. So therefore, his was newsworthy and deserved investigation.
Yeah.
But Bush's didn't.
Well, you know, the Jennifer Fitzgerald story did not get as much traction as the Jennifer Flowers. But
at a late date already, playing for a politician.
Yeah, but that was that transition, right? The Cold War just ended. There was still this sense of the sanctity of the Oval Office. However, it didn't prevent a CNN reporter from asking about the affair in a press conference that George Bush held with Yitzhak Rabin. Or Stone Phillips from asking about it in the Oval Office. So the cracks were already beginning under George Bush, and then, of course, the dam blew open under Bill Clinton. Ma'am, did you have a hand?
Yeah. I'm just curious. I was curious because, to me, the McCarthy era is always one of power gone amok. Is there something that ties back to any sexual rumors there?
It's a long story, but basically, Joe McCarthy had on his staff a guy named Roy Cohn, And Roy was in love with David Shine, another staffer, right? And Joe McCarthy at first went after the State Department, but then he started, after he didn't find any real communists there, he started going after the Defense Department. That was too much for Dwight Eisenhower. That was a bridge too far. So the Dwight Eisenhower decided, all right, why don't we push this story about Roy Cohn and Shine and their weird relationship with Joe McCarthy. And that was the genesis of the Army-McCarthy hearings, right? Because McCarthy then turns that back on the president and is like, we need to have hearings about how, you know, these questions have arisen as to Shine and Cohn. That was basically Dwight Eisenhower's attempt to destroy Joe McCarthy playing the gay card. That was the origins of the Army-McCarthy hearings. It's a complicated story, but it gets a lot of play in the book, so you'll enjoy it there. In the back?
Well, thanks. I'll put it up Thanks. Yeah, how you doing? I'm sorry. I'm an arrest homicide officer named Tim Williams, right? And we basically are investigating a 9-year case. And the statements that you stated about political questionary and also hitnery are actually factual. And the reason why I'm saying that, because recently a situation happened dealing with a campaign that your company had basically dealt with, the AIDS virus. And it's been polluted in stores. We're investigating it now. And the reason why I asked you this is because I wanted to know, do you have, or may I ask, how do you feel about the AIDS situation? Because the company in which you dealt with, and still do deal with, basically have campaigns against it, and we're against it as well. You know, that's like, and I noticed in your statements that you have more political boundaries.
I think that we're just going to take questions about the book.
I mean, well, that's what I'm
saying. Yeah, yeah. Ben Franklin, in the city of Philadelphia, Ben Franklin, yes, yes. Ben Franklin is the key, obviously not a president, but a pivotal force in American politics, builds a media empire in large part through the use of gossip stories, actually runs kind of tabloid journalism, and builds this national media network on it, and was a well-known ladies' man. And when the Continental Congress needed to find an appropriate ambassador to France, where the infamous for their sexual mores, the best man was, of course, Ben Franklin. Even though he was 70 years old, he was still known as quite the Casanova, and they knew this would be a huge asset because the political elite structure in France was run through the salons, which were run through the ladies. So Ben Franklin goes over there, uses his reputation for success with the French ladies to bolster the image of America among the French, and uses his connections through a couple of his mistresses, Madame Briand and Madame Helvidius, to connect in with the French power structure, and successfully convinces the French to support the American Revolution, and of course, that helps us out, but it also winds up bankrupting the French monarchy and brings them their revolution. So Franklin's ladies' man seduction winds up leading to two successful revolutions. Yeah.
Not that you can necessarily paint them all with the same brush, but I'm just going to throw out a couple, like contemporary, the governor of South Carolina with the whole Appalachian Trail thing, and Larry Craig. I guess what I was asking is, in your research, do you think that what is the gene that is not kicking in with these guys, where most of us would make decisions to know to not do stuff like this that would likely get yourself caught?
Right.
When these are people that are very obviously under the public eye, is it that they surround themselves with people that don't say boo about what they're doing?
No.
They seem to lose all kind of common sense about these issues.
Look, you'll find that most people that go into politics who are very active, libido, a huge ego, and they feed this ego off their sexual conquest. Now, most of the people that get busted in these sex scandals are real scum, from Bitter, from Louisiana to Livingston, the guy who was trying to get Clinton, and it goes on and on. But one of the national TV shows is a Rachel Maddow show. She did a story on this guy from South Carolina who you just mentioned about
Mark
the
Sanford.
Mark Sanford. And so I wrote her a letter, and I said, Rachel, I said, look, leave him alone. At least he fell in love. I said, you know, the rest of these creeps were just after the sex. And she kept that letter, so recently when I was at a show, she reminded me of that. And if you read any of his writings, letters that he wrote to his Argentina girl and you know, the guy was hopelessly in love. He had been smitten by her, you know. So what do you do in a situation like that? He really wasn't a typical politician getting involved in some sort of sex scandal, you know. He just fell in love.
Yes, sir.
Two questions. You did mention
in the beginning the name Truman. I never thought that there was any scandal about Truman.
Not Harry. No, there wasn't. I didn't mention Harry. But anyway, and he's one of the good, really clean guys.
Number two, you never mentioned LBJ.
Oh, boy. Yep. Yeah, Lyndon. Lyndon was funny because, you know, he always resented Kennedy because Kennedy had such a reputation, whereas he said, I can't even use how he put it, but he said, I get more sex than that guy I could get, working in an entire year. I get it in a week. So Lyndon constantly, had this desire to one-up Kennedy. And in the sexual realm, he came pretty damn close. So Lyndon Johnson is definitely up there.
The funniest story that I ever heard about Johnson was Doris Kearns Goodwin, very famous historian. She'd written extensively about Clinton or Lincoln, and she also wrote LBJ's autobiography. So when LBJ retired, and she went down to the ranch to spend some time with him writing the biography, in the middle of the night, she felt somebody crawling in bed with her. So he said, in his southern drawl, he said, "Oh, honey, don't worry, this is your president." Doris actually tells the story, it was really funny.
Sir? Oh, right.
Thank you. In your research, do the names Lou Wasserman ever come up?
Lou Wasserman. Universal
Studios.
How
he had his hands on virtually every president up through, I believe, Reagan.
I know Lou Wasserman well.
Well, you knew him.
He's a huge donor for the Democratic Party. I haven't heard anything negative about him. It's all been positive.
Do you believe he actually was a kingmaker?
Well, he gathered up the Hollywood money, which is very important to anybody who's running for president. He was the point man on that.
We have time for two more questions right over here.
Anything on George W.?
Thank you.
Not that we put in the book. Let's put it that way. Right over there, ma'am.
Your premise that the press doesn't cover this, I can't think of the name of the senator who challenged the press. He was running a very active campaign, and he got in. Pardon?
Gary Hart?
Yes.
1988,
yes.
Gary Hart.
And
Monkey Business.
Miss, I don't remember what her name was, but she went into business with No Excuse Jeans.
Yes.
And it absolutely ruined his career.
Right.
And the other part of it, the other part of that observation is, you spoke about Senior Bush's affair and how he shut it down. And the scandal with the Clarence Thomas during his administration, there's a very bitter irony there.
Yeah. Yeah, well, Gary Hart, the photograph killed him, right? That was it. Once that Monkey Business photograph came out, it was impossible for the people to kind of see him as seriously as a presidential candidate anymore. And he had a very good shot at becoming president in 1988. And he was leading in the polls.
A good friend of mine, Bill Zimmerman, was Gary Hart's campaign manager. And I said, how did you think about dealing with that? He said, well, I told Gary what he should do at the press conference is say, I'll take the vote of every man that never cheated.
All right, we have one more. You're right in the front here.
This is more of a comment. It seems like nowadays the political wives are no longer standing in the press conferences with their cheating husbands. Didn't know if there was anything behind that other than just the women being more, I don't know, modern or just simply saying, you know what,
yeah.
I'm not doing this anymore.
I think it's become, we've had so many sex scandals that it became cliche. It was almost kind of ridiculous having the wife next to them. So they've decided, no, don't even bother anymore. Just go out there and, you know, do your mea culpa and hopefully this thing blows over. So I think that that's the new trend in presidential sex scandal or political sex scandal. All right. Well, thank you all. This was tremendous.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.